everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if, like us, you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me.
As always, thank you for all your support so far on our podcast.
Please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Murder, Mother and Me Podcast. Share with your friends and please write us a review.
But only if it's a good one. This week we are talking about a story that takes place way back in 1931. Here are a few interesting facts about that year.
The first prototype of the electric guitar was invented and patented in 1931 by George Beauchamp. The Star Spangled Banner becomes the US official national anthem. In Fort Lauderdale, Florida, a stray goat was elected mayor as a joke by locals frustrated with politicians.
Bit like Donald Trump as president, isn't it?
A goat? Gary the goat?
Oh, Gary the goat, yeah. You can go with Derek the dog.
Also, can I just say, 1931 to me seems like it was 400 years ago.
It was nearly 100 years ago now, though, wasn't it, really? It was,
I know, like, but it just sounds
ago.
Like...
Oh, 94 years ago,
but that just seems like a completely different age.
Well, it was almost a century ago, and I can guarantee that people in 1931 were going, oh my god, 1831, that seems like a, you know,
yeah, or I wonder what it's going to be like in 2031.
But look how things have changed in all that time. Somebody from 1931 would not believe the world that we live in. I mean, there's people alive from 1931, obviously, isn't
it? How old were you in 1931?
That's not funny, that, you know. I actually feel about 95 today. Right, everyone, let's get on with this week's episode. This is the infamous murder of Julia Wallace. Our story begins in Liverpool, a bustling city in northwest England. It's January the 20th, 1931, a cold winter's evening in the suburb of Anfield. Julia Wallace, a 52-year-old housewife, is at home. Her husband, William Herbert Wallace, a 52-year-old insurance agent, is out on his weekly chess club meeting. By the end of the night, Julia will be found brutally murdered in her own living room, and William will be accused of the crime in what would become one of the most infamous murder trials in British history. But before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. Julia Wallace was born in 1879. Bloody hell, 1879! I wasn't expecting that. I'll start again. Julia Wallace was born in 1879. Described by friends and neighbours as a reserved and gentle woman, Julia was not known to have any enemies. She married William in 1914, and by all outward appearances, their marriage was stable, though not particularly passionate. The couple lived a modest life at 29 Wolverton Street, a typical terraced house in the working-class neighbourhood of Anfield. Julia was said to be a devoted wife who spent most of her time at home, keeping the household running smoothly while William worked as an insurance agent.
If you've listened to our podcast from the first episode, you will know that we are both from Liverpool, so we know these areas in this story quite well. But what do you think Anfield was like at that time? I'm not saying it like you were there, don't worry. I'm just asking. You'll have a better idea than I will.
I know this area really well because we lived actually in a house at one point when I was a teenager, just very close to where Wolverton Street was. So we would pass it daily. I would pass it daily, especially when I went out with my mum shopping. We'd walk up there, both of us, but even then we're like true crime addicts. And of course, because it was a local murder, you know, we'd talk about it all the time. We'd pass this house and we couldn't resist going and standing in front of it and imagining, you know, the goings on of that night. Strangely, most of my family on my mum's side grew up in this area. So there's a road close by called Townsend. There's Townsend Lane, which a lot of things pertain to this story. There was some goings on there, and Lower Breck Road runs alongside it as well. And so there was a lot of sort of those roads involved in this story.
So you're actually very familiar with the area?
Yeah, I lived in this area, right in this area, and... my grandmother, my mum's mum, lived in this area, and William Herbert Wallace was actually her insurance agent, and also some of my great aunts. So he would go around their houses and they were familiar with him on a personal basis.
And here we are telling the story.
And here we are all these years later telling the story, yeah. But the area itself was just, you know, I think at that time it would have been a nice, well-kept area. It wasn't bad when I was growing up there, but the roads are only small. Wolverton Street is a dead-end street, a cul-de-sac, so it's got like an entryway and alleyway running along the back of it. So, but the houses are like terraced houses and it's only a small road. So, you know, everybody would have knew what was going on. Everyone in that road would have known each other. Physically, Julia was slight and frail, standing about 5 feet tall and weighing less than 100 pounds. Despite her small stature, those who knew her noted that she had a strong sense of propriety and was meticulous about her home and personal affairs. Julia's quiet life made the brutal nature of her death all the more shocking. So who was William Herbert Wallace? William Herbert Wallace was a man of routine and intellect. Born in 1878, he was known as a methodical and disciplined individual. His work as an insurance agent required him to be precise and organised, traits that carried over into his personal life. Wallace was also an avid chess player, a hobby he pursued with great enthusiasm. He was a regular at the Central Chess Club in Liverpool, where he often engaged in friendly matches with fellow enthusiasts. Despite his outwardly respectable demeanour, Wallace was described by some as aloof and peculiar. He was not particularly sociable and had a somewhat standoffish personality. Financially, the Wallaces were not wealthy, but they were comfortable enough to maintain a modest lifestyle. However, there were rumours that the couple's finances were not as secure as they appeared, and this would later become a point of contention during the investigation.
So it sounds like so far that they're just quite a regular couple.
Yeah, just an average Mr. and Mrs., you know, that lived
from Liverpool
in a quiet suburb. They didn't have any children, and they were, I think, considered old at that time, weren't they, for that, you know, 50-odd was old then. And when you see photographs of them, they actually look old. You know, now a 52-year-old would not look like that, I don't think. But to look at, he was the archetypal intellectual. You know, he was tall, thin. He had, like, sort of like a droopy handlebar moustache and wire-rimmed glasses.
Physically, what you've just described is how I picture every man from 1931, to be honest.
Well,
they
sure.
All look like they have them moustaches with the glasses and the top hats on. That's what I
Can
see.
Can we just get this straight? I don't think there was any top hats.
I know, but that's just what I see when
and
you say 1931.
And especially not in this sort of kind of working class, you know, setting, really. I think you're going back to Jack the Ripper times there.
Yeah, that's
so
what
that
I'm
was
thinking.
A little bit before
Jack. I'm thinking he looks like Jack the Ripper.
He doesn't... Well, we don't know what Jack the Ripper looks like.
Yeah,
don't
true.
Start that debate, for God's sake.
And also, when he's described as aloof and peculiar, I wonder how peculiar he actually was.
I think you find that people say this after the fact, don't they? Maybe if this trial and murder had not happened, they would have found him perfectly normal. He's probably just a normal person, but he just had a few little quirks like everybody else. 2 days before the murder, on January the 19th, 1931, William Wallace received a peculiar phone call. The call was made to the Central Chess Club at the City Cafe, where Wallace was a regular member. The caller asked for Wallace by name and left a message for him. The man, who identified himself as R.M. Qualtroff, claimed to want to meet Wallace regarding insurance business. He instructed Wallace to come to a specific address, 25 Menlove Gardens East, at 7:30 p.m. the following evening.
I'm going to interrupt here to say...
You're not going to say Qualtroff, are you?
No, I'm not going to say Qualtroff. What I am going to say is Menlove Gardens is an area that I grew up in, pretty much. It's pretty much 5 minutes from where we are right now. So Menlove Gardens is an area that I'm very familiar with. I had a lot of friends that I went to school with that lived actually around the area of Menlove Gardens. So for this to be part of the story is quite weird.
I think as well, Menlove Gardens now even, but at that time, was a more affluent area. So him getting this call would mean big business for him, I think. You know, he would want to go there and find out what it was all about, wouldn't he? You know, to make some money.
Well, it's quite a, I would say, a middle to upper class area, even now. So I can only imagine back then that it was even more so.
Yeah, it's full of professional people, isn't it? And I would imagine it would have been the same at that time.
And also, is it not a bit weird that he's getting a call at the chess club about business? Because surely in 1931, well, not surely, I know there was no mobile phones, so... Why is he calling the chess club? I would assume if there's a phone at the chess club, you could probably have a phone at your home.
It would have been costly though, wouldn't it? I suppose it's not an everyday thing, I don't think, to have a phone at home.
Okay, so then my next question would be, if they didn't ring the chess club, how does he conduct his business? Is it just a door-to-door speaking to people?
I think most of his work would have been passed on by the company he worked for, which was the Prudential Insurance. They had a big building in town, so I'm guessing that he would have got some kind of weekly router of clients that he needed to visit. And then he would have developed his own clientele along the way, his regulars that he went, because in them days you'd go to the house, which sounds ridiculous now because it's all done online, isn't it? But, you know, when you would collect the insurance money every week, and it was all done manually like that. And also, it wasn't unknown for people to call actually at his home to do business with him, because he was a well-known figure in the area. As in those days, you knew the milkman, you knew the coal man, you knew the insurance man. Do you know what I mean? You knew them all.
Sorry, what is a coal man?
Exactly, that's what I mean. This is how you kept warm, Josh. This is how you kept warm. You know, you couldn't flick a switch and put yourself...
No underfloor heating?
Absolutely not, no. It was freezing. He had outside toilet that you went to and horrible toilet paper that was like cardboard. I know, it even sounds weird to me now. This call was highly unusual for several reasons. First, it was rare for clients to contact Wallace at the chess club, as most of his business was conducted during regular working hours or at his home. Second, the name R.M. Qualtroff was unfamiliar to Wallace, and the caller's tone was described as deliberate but unfamiliar. Witnesses who overheard the conversation remarked on the formality of the caller's speech, which some later speculated might have been an attempt to disguise their identity.
Okay, so it seems like, you know, Willie Wallace here is a bit confused by this call as well.
Willie Wallace?
Yeah, I've just shortened his name. I think it sounds good.
I like that, Willie Wallace. I think what happened was the call came in while he wasn't at the chess club and there was a message left for him. I think when they're talking about the caller speaking, it was somebody else who spoke to the caller and noted, you know, made these notes about the way he spoke.
But even then, when he's been passed this message on, he must be thinking, who's been trying to contact me at the chess club?
Well, probably, but I think when he saw the address, it was like jackpot time. He probably thought it was a good haul for himself.
And even that name, R.M. Qualtroff, like, it's not like a usual name, is it?
It's a really strange name, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like RMS Titanic or something.
Yeah, it sounds quite royal, doesn't it? Like, quite regal.
And I think that's a case in point, isn't it? Because why was this name chosen? Because as we'll find out, this person didn't exist as a real person. Even the initials RM, and then Qualtroff is such an unusual name. The only reason why you would invent a name like that would be so that it was remembered.
Yeah, and I wonder if, you know, the initials or anything actually play a part in, and is it like a secret clue or something?
Well, that's something I don't think we'll ever know.
Okay, so this random person, RM Qualtroff, has called the chess club. Willie Wallace is not there, but he's been passed on the message that he needs to be at Menlove Gardens East at 7:30 p.m.
Despite the oddity, Wallace accepted the meeting without suspicion. He was known for his diligence as an insurance agent and likely saw the meeting as an opportunity to secure a new client. However, the timing and method of contact would later become a focal point of the investigation. Who was R.M. Qualtroff and why did they choose to arrange this meeting in such an elaborate and unusual way? The address provided, 25 Menlove Gardens East, added to the intrigue. Menlove Gardens was a real area in Liverpool, but there was no east among its streets, only west, north and south. Was this a genuine mistake on the part of the caller, or a deliberate ruse to mislead Wallace? The purpose of the phone call remains one of the most enduring mysteries of this case.
I mean, I actually didn't know there wasn't a Menlove Gardens east, to be honest. I knew there was a west and a north because I had friends that lived on both of those. So you would assume that there was a south and an east as well.
Well, that's what you'd assume, because why is the one missed out, by the way, do you know?
No.
I mean, the way they're laid out, do they actually go north, south and west? And then why is there not an east? Is there something else there to stop there being an east? I'm just a bit intrigued by that.
And it seems like whoever this caller is, I feel like they knew there wasn't a Menlove Gardens east. That's the vibe that I'm getting. I don't think it was a mistake.
I feel that as well. If you lived in one of those roads, you're not going to mistake... You know, you're not going to say east instead of west or north or south, are you? On January the 20th, William Wallace set out to find 25 Menlove Gardens East. But when he arrived in the Menlove Gardens area, he discovered there was no such address. Menlove Gardens West, North and South existed, but not East. Wallace asked several locals for directions and even consulted a police officer, but no one could help him locate the non-existent address. Frustrated and confused, Wallace decided to return home. When Wallace arrived at his house around 8:45 p.m, he found the door locked. After struggling to get inside, he eventually gained entry and made a horrifying discovery. Julia's lifeless body was found in the parlour, lying in a pool of blood. She had been brutally beaten to death, suffering at least 11 blows to her head, with what was later determined to be a blunt instrument, possibly a metal bar or a fire poker.
I know this is a bit of a random question, but do you know if he got the bus?
Well, he didn't walk, did he, from Menlove
Gardens? Or did he drive?
No, he didn't drive. He got a tram. In them days, there was
trams in Liverpool?
There was trams for years in Liverpool, so I think there were a better service than the buses now. But here's an interesting fact as well. At that time, although it was trams, I think they still carried the same numbers as the buses do today. So if I'm right, I think Willie got on the 86 tram. Sorry, I've got to say Willie. I shouldn't have said Willie to make me laugh now. William would have got on the 86 tram.
Is the 86 bus that we would get into the city centre from where we live.
I think they still follow more or less the same route, you know. And then when he returned home, the house was in complete darkness. So I think that rang an alarm bell. He tried to get in through the front door, but the front door was locked from the inside. So he then went round the back. But the strange thing is, or maybe not so strange, because it's probably what I'd do, he knocked at the neighbour's house and asked them to accompany him round the back before he actually went in. I mean, that could have just been because he was, you know, the lights were all off and he...
Maybe he was a bit frightened.
Yeah, an instinct, about what he would find. So, but they were with him when he gained access. The back door was open and he went in.
And is it a bit weird that the front door was locked but the back door wasn't?
I think that's what alarmed him. When you think about it, you know, why would the front door be locked? The house is in darkness. He went round the back with the neighbours, but they didn't actually go into the house with him. He went in and then came out and told them that she was dead. The crime scene was nothing short of a nightmare. Julia's body was found partially slumped against an armchair, her head battered so severely that fragments of her skull were shattered. Blood spatter covered the walls, ceiling and furniture, painting a gruesome picture of the violence inflicted upon her. A small table had been overturned and a teacup lay shattered on the floor, suggesting that Julia had been caught off guard while she was at ease. One of the most perplexing aspects of the crime scene was the absence of any clear evidence pointing to a motive. There was no sign of forced entry, no items of value were missing, and Julia's clothing remained undisturbed. The attack appeared to be one of extreme personal violence, carried out with great ferocity, but seemingly without a clear reason.
I was just going to say, I think attacks like this, it paints a picture of something very personal, doesn't it?
When the police investigated, there was items strewn across the rooms. There was a cash box that was being, I think, sort of rifled with, but nothing was taken. You would think with a robbery, why would they not take that? You know.
Yeah, so possibly someone trying to stage a robbery.
Or maybe someone that was caught in the middle of a robbery. You have to consider as well the fact that she possibly knew who it was. If it wasn't William Wallace and it was somebody else, it could have been someone familiar to her. So there wouldn't need to be anyone gaining entry if she opened the front door and let them in. And the fact that the cash box had been interfered with, could that have been, as I say, somebody she's familiar with? She's gone to make a cup of tea, made the cup of tea, brought it in, and found this person going through her belongings.
Yeah, and I think that level of violence is always a clear sign of a personal motive rather than kind of a off-the-cuff, I'm just going to kill you now in the moment type of thing.
Just to keep them quiet or something.
Yeah, because usually what you find is when it's a spur-of-the-moment thing, it's usually a lot less violent and just the quickest option.
Yeah, just to keep them quiet and to escape, really.
So usually strangulation or something like that to keep them quiet, but when you're bashing someone's skull in to the point where there's blood spatter on the ceiling and things like that, that's a much more, I personally feel like it's a much more motivated, like, personal attack. You want to hurt that person, you want to cause as much damage as possible.
Yeah, it's like there's a connection to them, isn't there?
So for me, it would make sense that it was someone either close to her or someone that she knew or someone that had some kind of problem or vendetta.
I mean, she wouldn't have put up much of a defence, would she? She was only tiny. And it wouldn't have taken much to sort of disable her and bring her down to the ground. And so to keep an attack going like that does show some kind of emotional involvement, I think.
And also, who's to say that it's not someone that has a problem with William and not necessarily Julia, but she just happened to be the target of the attack to get at him in a way?
Yeah, that's a good point. And then you know, it could have been William himself, because we've not ruled anything out at this point. Investigators noted that the fire in the parlour fireplace had been stoked recently, indicating that Julia had likely been alive and tending to the home not long before her death. The time of death was estimated to be around 8 p.m, just as Wallace was wandering the streets of Menlove Gardens in search of the fictitious address. Adding to the mystery, the murder weapon was never found. Police searched the house and surrounding areas extensively, but could locate neither the blunt instrument nor any bloody clothing that the killer might have discarded. This lack of physical evidence made the case against Wallace, or any other potential suspect, increasingly circumstantial.
And I mean, we're not to forget that we're in 1931 here. There's no DNA evidence, there's no fingerprint technology, there's nothing, is there really?
I didn't think there was even a flushing toilet.
That's what I'm saying. So it would have been incredibly hard for them to find any evidence at the scene, I would imagine.
Well, actually, when they found her, there was an overcoat underneath her, like a raincoat. And they think this might have been worn by Wallace. I think it was one of his coats. So how that got underneath her, we don't know.
But what I'm saying is, even still, you're not able to get prints or blood analysis or anything off it at DNA. That time, are you?
I think DNA would have been a great help in this case.
So really, that coat being underneath it, it really doesn't prove anything?
Well, what it indicates is that whoever killed her wore this coat to stop blood spatter going on them. They had the presence of mind to do that, so it kind of points to a premeditated, you know, someone thinking about the consequences of what might happen and how it would implicate them and guarding against that. But as you say, there was no DNA evidence.
Well, I think in that time, you're looking at really, unless you're catching someone red-handed with the murder weapon in their hand covered in blood, how are you going to prove that it was anyone back then?
Or there was eyewitnesses. In and out the property. And actually, when they found Julia, the fire in the parlour had been stoked, as they said, so it was burning for quite a while, you know, on full heat sort of thing. And that would affect, the outside temperature affects the body when it's dead, you know, because what they were pinpointing the time of death by at that time was the onset of rigor mortis, and that is governed by outside temperatures.
And because the fire had been burning for quite a while, I would imagine it had kept the room at a reasonably high temperature, which had maybe stopped the onset of rigor mortis for a little bit. I don't really know the scientific explanation.
Well, rigor mortis is the settling of blood to the lowest point of the body, so when blood stops circulating, it's gonna sink downwards. But I think when this, you know, the outside temperature is warm, it's almost mimicking, isn't it, the body staying warm. So they couldn't actually pinpoint it, and they did at 8 o'clock, but then that was changed later on to 6 p.m. and that's a huge difference, that 2 hours. And this,
well, I guess the biggest difference is if it was 6 p.m. he wouldn't be at Menlove Gardens, would he?
Exactly, that 2 hour window is a huge difference of time. It changes alibis and, you know, the circumstances as to where people were at certain times. That is, it's not 5 minutes, it's not 10 minutes, it's 2 hours. The police were called to the scene immediately. Wallace's demeanour was described as detached, which some officers found suspicious, though others attributed it to shock. Wallace claimed he had no idea who could have committed such a heinous act. However, suspicion quickly fell on him. The police found no signs of forced entry, suggesting Julia's killer was either someone she knew or someone who had a key to the house. Wallace, as her husband, fit both criteria. Adding to the suspicion were inconsistencies in Wallace's story. Neighbours reported seeing Wallace leave the house at a time that conflicted with his stated departure for the chess club. Additionally, his account of discovering Julia's body raised questions. Wallace stated that he had to unlock 2 doors to enter the house, yet police found only 1 locked door, which could be opened with Julia's key. Was this a lapse in memory or a sign of a deliberate fabrication?
I think this is the age-old thing, isn't it, of you can't judge someone based on their reaction to a crime, especially if it's a spouse or a family member or something. Of course he's going to be in bloody shock. His wife's just had her head bashed in.
Every murder case that this happens in, where someone discovers a body or whatever, this is always raised, isn't it? You know, and as we always say, no one can put themselves in those shoes. I think it's such an unusual situation that how would you know how you're going to react? It might have been he was on autopilot, just going through things. And in those days as well, they tended to be more reserved, didn't they? And men, especially of his age, you know, were considered, it was not right to show emotion. So I think just the society that he was part of at the time would dictate how he acted as well.
What are you thinking so far then? Are you thinking that it could have been him? Are you thinking it could have been someone else?
At this point, I think it could have been virtually anybody. I see why he's an obvious suspect, but then it could have been anybody who lived in the street that knew that he was out, that knew Julia personally. It could have been an acquaintance. It could have been a client. It could have been a burglar who knew there was money in the house.
At this point, I think you're right. I think it literally could be anyone. There's not even like anyone we can pinpoint it to right now, is there? I mean, the only one that has the means, I guess, is William Wallace. But if he is out at Menlove Gardens, then obviously that's not possible.
Wallace was arrested and charged with Julia's murder. His trial began in April 1931 and attracted widespread public attention. The prosecution argued that Wallace had staged the phone call to himself and concocted the story about Menlove Gardens East to establish an alibi. They claimed he killed Julia before leaving for the chess club meeting and that his later confusion about the address was an act. So when William Wallace left the house to go to his chess club, this was like a big bone of contention with the police and the investigation. He had to walk down to Townsend Lane and get a bus into town. And I think what they were saying earlier was there was a dispute about the time he left the house. There was a phone box right by the bus stop where he would board it to get into town. And what they were trying to say was that that phone call was made by him to the chess club purporting to be Mr. Qualtrough. So he actually staged that himself.
I just can't wrap my head around why he would do that. It doesn't even feel like he's got a motive.
Well, we don't know, do we? We don't know. It said earlier on that the marriage was passionless. Did you see my air quotes then?
I seen your air quotes.
And so maybe it was. Maybe there was nothing there. And maybe they hated each other. We don't know. But in those days, it's not like now. We're on Facebook. Everyone's relationship is open for public dissection. In them days, it was all very private. So really, and it was all very proper, wasn't it? So really, I don't think anyone would know. Maybe relatives and friends close to them may know, but nobody else would know, so...
I think the one thing that's sticking with me about this phone call as well is the fact that it said something about the person's voice, this Qualtrough's voice. It sounded like it was almost put on, like someone was trying to disguise their real voice.
Or is that just something you think in hindsight when you know all this has happened? Or maybe they didn't notice it at the time and it did seem strange.
Possibly, but... I'm trying to think of a way that it could be William Wallace. And to me, that would be a way that it's him if he's gone to this phone box and he's put on a different voice to try and make it seem like it was someone else. But I don't know. It's not sitting right with me.
But if you know you're going to kill someone, you're not going to use your own voice, are you? Especially if you may be in the circle of those people. You know, maybe you went to the chess club yourself and that's how he knew William Wallace. If you're going to set somebody up for a murder, do you know what I mean? You're going to disguise yourself as much as possible. The evidence against Wallace was largely circumstantial. There was no direct proof tying him to the murder weapon, which was never found. Nonetheless, the jury found Wallace guilty, and he was sentenced to death by hanging. However, his conviction was soon overturned on appeal due to insufficient evidence. This was one of the first instances in British legal history where a murder conviction was quashed by the Court of Criminal Appeal.
I just find it honestly bizarre that someone can be sentenced to death by hanging, of all things. I mean, I know that was still a thing back then, but...
In Liverpool,
death by hanging, with really no evidence.
There was nothing tying him to it.
I know they're saying it's all circumstantial, but really, there is no evidence.
But now you can win a case on the weight of circumstantial evidence. But there really wasn't any, was there?
But that's what I'm saying. I feel like the evidence that they have isn't really evidence.
So imagine being in this trial... being the accused in this trial. This trial was held at St. George's Hall, the courts of law underneath the Crown Courts. And then seeing the judge come out after hearing all this and the jury have found you guilty, and then he puts that black cap on and sentences you to death and you've done nothing.
It's absolutely horrendous. I can't get over the fact that that was the sentence. Of all things, that the sentence was death by hanging. Because... There's
and
nothing.
It wasn't proved.
But there's not one thing that points to him, really. There's not one definite thing.
He was just happened to be out the house on that evening, and a number of people could have known that. Which, again, there's got to be some kind of motive, hasn't there? If someone set this up and took the time to obviously arrange a meeting from somewhere fictitious, and actually it's a long way away from where he was, so they've made him travel the furthest distance, haven't they? Knowing that he's going to be out for a considerable time, which would then allow them to perpetrate this murder. So it makes sense really in that way, doesn't it?
I mean, listen, it very well could have been him. and he's just managed to cover it up really well, and that be that. But I really do feel like it's not him. I feel like he's been set up.
I don't think it's him. That's my view on it. I've read quite a lot of the case, and I've always thought that. Now, at the time, because through relatives, you know, we were told, people did say he was a bit strange. I think it was just the way he kind of was very austere, do you know what I mean, and strict-looking sort of thing. I think the consensus of the local area and from the people who knew him as clients, etc., was that he didn't commit this crime. To this day, the murder of Julia Wallace remains unsolved, and numerous theories have been proposed. Some believe Wallace was indeed the killer, motivated by financial difficulties or marital discord. Others suggest the crime was the work of an unknown intruder who had access to the house. A particularly compelling theory implicates a man named Richard Gordon Parry, a former employee of Wallace who allegedly had a grudge against him. Parry was known to have a set of keys to the Wallace home and was rumoured to have a history of criminal behaviour. Shall we talk a bit about Richard Gordon Parry?
I would like to know a little bit more because this is the first time I'm hearing his name.
As it says, he actually worked for William Wallace at one point. I think he was taken on as kind of like a junior insurance clerk, sort of collecting money, etc. And he wasn't a trustworthy person, so there was a dispute about whether he stole money. He was collecting the money and maybe keeping some of it, I think is what it was. And because of this, he was sacked, and William Wallace had a hand in that. Well, I'm guessing he would have had a hand in that, wouldn't he, if he was on his beat, so to speak, and the insurance officers would want to know what was going on. So whether he wanted to sort of job him in or not, he would have had to. So there's a motive right away, isn't it?
Well, that plays into what I was saying earlier about it might not necessarily be a problem with Julia, but it might be a problem with William.
Yeah.
And this is obviously could be deemed as a clear problem with William.
But what concerns me about this is, why does he have a set of keys to the Wallace home?
That's what I thought when you just read it.
I don't remember anything about that, to be honest, but...
Well, maybe they were friendly enough that...
Why, though? Why would you be going into the house? Would it be just to... What I'm thinking is, was he depositing money that he collected to leave for William to...
Well, yeah, and maybe if he was working alongside William, it could have been like... Maybe William gave him a couple of his own clients, and he's gone to collect their money, and he's brought it back to the house, and William's not there.
That's what I'm
As
saying,
you said, was, there was a cash box there, so maybe that was to deposit the money.
And with Willie being out so much, maybe he gave him a key to say, you know, just drop it off there and put it in the box. I'm just guessing this, don't know, but that's what it sounds like.
This is just pure speculation.
We could probably find this out and probably should have done, but... Also, it raises the question, doesn't it, that he would have known Julia, wouldn't he? So... Was there any kind of...
Well, again, that kind of might play into when you were saying about, you know, she'd made the cup of tea. She could have made the cup of tea for him. Had he come round and said, let's just sit and have a chat and catch up or something?
I'm thinking, though, was there some kind of a more personal relationship, a romantic relationship maybe, with them saying the marriage was passionless? Was this something that just, you know, they became familiar and then maybe something started off?
I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? It's like, obviously they jumped straight on the William train of thinking that it's him, but there are actually other options that it doesn't seem like were considered at all.
So just a bit more about Richard Parry. So what points to him for me, because I actually think that he committed this crime, that's my own personal opinion, was the fact that he was familiar with the surroundings, he knew the streets, he knew both William and Julia, he had access to the house, he knew that money was collected and left in that house, and he was a bit of a petty criminal or a thief. And that day that the murder occurred was the day when all of the money would have been together in that house. So he knew that. So what better day to conduct a robbery than that one?
Well, and I suppose also it wouldn't have alarmed Julia if he turned up at the house, potentially.
Exactly. Never mind the keys. If he knocked at the door...
She probably would have let him in.
She would have let him in, yeah. Now, did it go wrong? Did she catch him rifling through the cash box because nothing was taken? Did she disturb him and just out of... panic, he picked the nearest thing up, which probably would have been the poker on the fire hearth, and beat her to death, and just wanted to make sure she was dead and just didn't stop. That is still a personal thing, isn't it? This poker that they think the crime was committed with, I mean, it was missing from the house, so it points to that as being the murder weapon. They never ever found it. And they did look down sewers and everything. But it could have been taken anywhere, couldn't it? Also, on the day of the murder, there was a local garage, and Richard Gordon Parry took his car there and asked them to clean it meticulously inside and out. And when, years later, in the 60s it was, they re-interviewed the people around at that time. And, you know, in those days, police investigations were not as thorough, I don't think, as they are now. And people may have been missed off. But they interviewed an employee at the garage who said, you know, he absolutely remembers him asking for this car to be thoroughly cleaned. And when they did clean it, they found a bloody glove underneath, I think it was the dashboard or the seat or something in the car. And this was never, I mean, why that wasn't reported at the time, I really don't know. It's a bit like the OJ thing, this, isn't it? And also, his girlfriend at the time, I think her name was Lily, she gave him an alibi for that night and said that he was with her. And then years later, obviously after breakups and things in the 60s, she said that she'd made that up and he wasn't actually there with her.
So it sounds like Richard is a solid suspect, in my opinion.
I think he did it.
But then, so then, why was he not investigated more? I can't understand.
Well, he was investigated, but when someone gives you an alibi, you know, it's almost set in stone, isn't it, you know?
Well, also, I know we keep saying it, but this was in 1931, so how can they actually check your alibi? There is no way, really, is there, other than someone saying, yes, he was with me, and them going, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, it's just personal testimony, isn't it?
You know, now they have all kinds of ways. They can track your phone, they can check CCTV. There's loads of ways to check an alibi, whereas back then, I guess there was slim to no way.
Well, if somebody says, no, he was with me at that time, then
how can you prove that he wasn't?
You can't, can you? So, unless someone saw something, which they didn't. But this glove just drives me insane.
I think the thing is as well, it's one of those things where it still could be anyone. Yeah, he sounds like a solid suspect, but it could also be 100 other people.
I think you've got to, like they say, weigh up the amount of, whether it's circumstantial or not, weigh up the amount of evidence. And when you put William Wallace and Richard Gordon Parry side by side, what would you think looking at those two suspects? I mean, the thing is about him as well, he knew that William went to this chess club as well. He was familiar with all aspects of his life, really. He knew too much, didn't he, to not be a suspect, I think.
I mean, he's definitely a solid suspect, and it does raise the question of, did they do enough to investigate him?
I think it may have been they set the sights on William Wallace and that was it. And then they did look at other things, but it pointed to him in their eyes and they wanted a conviction and they just wanted to go after him. Another intriguing angle is the possibility that the mysterious R.M. Qualtrough was a real person, perhaps someone connected to Parry or another third party. The phone call remains one of the most puzzling aspects of the case. If Wallace didn't make the call, who did? So again, it could have been any of these people, couldn't it? It could have been Wallace himself setting up an alibi so that he could commit the murder. It could be Richard Gordon Parry because he wanted to set the scene to get Wallace out of the house. Or it could have been someone connected to Parry or any other suspect that we were unaware of to just, again, set the scene to get William out of the house.
I think that the phone call is the strangest. It's the strangest part of this case. Because it's the part that the only thing I can think of is that it was just a way to get him out of the house. That's it. But it just seems so bizarre, like the name and sending him to a false place that doesn't exist. It's a bit out there.
But it worked. The thing is as well, when he was on his way to the chess club, that phone box is like a triangular piece of grass, you know, and this phone box stood there for many years afterwards. I'd often walk past it and go, that's where that phone call was made. They know that's where that phone call was made because they traced it. Actually, they could trace phone calls, can you believe that? And it was traced to that phone box. So whoever that call came from made that call there. Now that could be, it's got to be someone familiar with that local area, so we know, I think, more or less it's someone from that area. Well, you know, probability says it's someone from that area, so it could have been William Wallace, or it could have been Richard Gordon Parry, or it could have been someone else from that area. I mean, the thing is, there wasn't that much cash in the house that it was a big-time robbery, that someone from another area, you know, like another city or something planned it, you know, and thought, we'll go and rob this house because it's full of money. So it would be someone who knew that there was money there, but it points more to like a petty sort of local criminality.
I don't actually think it was anything to do with the money. I don't think it was a robbery. I think it was a murder. and a purposeful murder, and I think it was to get at William for whatever reason. Maybe because he got Richard Gordon Parry fired or whatever, but I don't think the money actually plays a part in it. Do you actually know what happened to William Wallace after he was, you know, exonerated almost?
I think he went to live with his brother for a while, and he died a couple of years later. He had kidney problems. He'd had one kidney removed years before and had periodic bouts of illness because of it, and it was related to that. That was the reason he died.
I've actually just read that he died in 1933, so that was only 2 years after this whole ordeal had happened, which is not really a long time, is it?
Well, the fact that he was already ill and the toll this must have taken on him, can you imagine? Interestingly, Julia's sister and his own family and his colleagues all believed he was innocent right until the end. So that says something, I think, that her own sister didn't believe he was guilty. The Julia Wallace murder has been the subject of countless books, articles and documentaries. It's a case that continues to captivate true crime enthusiasts and amateur sleuths alike. Despite the passage of time, the questions linger. Who killed Julia Wallace? Was it her husband, a disgruntled acquaintance, or an unknown intruder? And what was the true purpose of the mystery phone call?
That's another one of those cases that I'm going to lose sleep over, because there are no answers again. And as much as I always say to you, I love the cases where there's a bit of mystery and there's, I know, where there's, like, you know, mysterious clues and stuff like that, it actually does annoy me at the same time, because I really want to know what actually happened.
Yeah, it's another one that's virtually unsolvable now, just like Jack the Ripper, because there's very limited evidence available. You know, there's no DNA or anything, so it's going to be one of those things that we're never going to get the answers to, unfortunately. I mean, was Willie a criminal mastermind with this innocent facade, you know, fooling everybody, including me, because I didn't think he did it. So, but then I stop and think, you know, it could have been him.
I mean, I feel like that entire episode, I was like, yeah, it's him. No, it's not him. But it could have been him. But actually, it sounds like it's someone else.
I think that's the way everyone feels, because there's so many things that point to the fact that he could have done it, including the fact that when he got off the tram in the Menlove area, you know, he made a point of asking a policeman. It was like as if he was cementing his alibi. Everything was so unusual about it. The actual name, the fact that the call came to the chess club, the fact that there was no Menlove Gardens East, and then asking a policeman. It was like cementing it in everyone's memory, wasn't it, that he was there? So you could look at it that way as well.
But you could also just look at it like he was just trying to do his job.
Yeah, he was just trying to do his job.
And find an address.
And he was set up. Yeah. But equally, it could have been a number of other people.
Well, that's another one that we'll never know, so...
Kind of sorry I did this case now. We used to walk past this house all the time. The people who lived in it must have been fed up, mustn't they? You know, and it, as I say, it was a cul-de-sac, so there was no way to get out at the end. So, apart from going around the entryways at the back of the house. So, you know, me and my mother would walk up that street so many times and stand there goggling at this house.
Well, to be honest, I didn't know anything about that case. I only know little bits and bobs from what you've told me, because it's one of those cases that you talk about all the time for some reason. I think obviously because you grew up with it, yeah. But now actually hearing it from start to finish with all the details and stuff, it is actually really interesting.
Yeah, you say you don't like the old cases, and it is nearly 100 years old now, isn't it? But
that was actually, yeah, it was very, very interesting.
Well, the same things apply, don't they? There's still the human element. They were people with lives that were, you know, with jobs and, you know, emotions and stuff. So you're just moving it from, it's in a different time to what you're familiar with, but it's still, all of those things still apply. I wonder who lives in that house now, though. They obviously know this murder took place there.
Would you live in that house?
Yeah, I'd live in the house, yeah.
Oh, there's absolutely no chance you'd catch me in there.
Okay, so you know this house you're sitting in now, where I live?
Yeah, but I don't know the history, so it's different.
Well, I'm going to tell you now, because before we
yes,
moved
I know in, he died, but he didn't get murdered with a bloody fire poker.
But the man who lived here before dropped dead on Christmas Day of a brain aneurysm right in the living room upstairs. So, you know, that's just as spooky,
Mum, that's
it?
Not the same thing.
No. Do you think, like, walls and stone and that absorb like energy of...
We're going into an entirely different podcast.
I'm just asking you a question though. Do you think, believe that that can happen?
No.
I do, because you know when you go into a house or something, you get a feeling. It's like what they say, isn't it? You know, you feel like an energy. So I think maybe it sort of imprints itself there like a negative, you know? But no, I would live in the house, yeah. I'd sit there and wonder though, and you'd look at the place where she lay, wouldn't you, and think, what the hell happened?
Okay, everyone, that's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.